We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's the True Faith Newcastle United podcast. It's a special podcast this week. We have a look back at season 1992-1993 with True Faith regular Mark Corby and George Coghlan, friend of the show and from The Athletic. And George, what a season. Long have you said, according to Mark, that this is your favourite season supporting Newcastle United all the way back in 1992-1993. Can you tell us, to kick the show off, why that is?
92-93 and 93-94, I would say. Well, tell you what, I'm going to read something from Kevin Keegan's first autobiography, if I may. I was about to embark on the most exciting year Newcastle will ever have. Even if they go on to win the championship and the European Cup, that 92-93 season will be hard to top. It was all so new to everyone that anything that followed was never as exciting, not even when we nearly won the championship. It was the season I will never forget. So, personally and professionally, it had a massive impact on my life. But it was also to do with the football that was played. But it was the feeling, I mean, the thing I love about it, and I love the fact that we're doing this now, 30 years on, because I think for the first time, those feelings are back again, certainly in some respects. That sense that Newcastle has a boundless ambition, that massive buzz around the city and the stadium on a match day, that feeling that anything is possible, that feeling that you're being carried away by it, the feeling that you're part of something that's bigger than you, is just so kind of profoundly special. The difference, I would argue, back then in 92-93 was that the football, you know, we haven't quite had that in the football sense yet in 2022. We've had an amazing recovery, but the football was like something I've never seen before in my life, and I can't imagine I'll see it ever again. And of course, as Keegan says in that thing, it was brand new. The club was coming from a position where the future was engraved out, and they went on and challenged, as we all know, at the top of the Premier League. And this was the season that got them there. It was incredible.
Mark, same question. Where does 92-93 rank for you, and why?
Well, me and George have got something in common straight away, because 92-94 is without a shadow of a doubt my most enjoyable time supporting Newcastle. You know, we've touched on, you know, the Champions League, the Bobby Robson era, all fantastic. But I think it was maybe of a sort of a coming of age period for me. Obsessed with Newcastle United. Every single penny I got went on Newcastle United, be it the match, be it a programme, be it a mag, a fanzine, away games. You know, it was just a pure bandwagon. And I'm sure we'll touch on Keegan in greater detail, but when he arrived, that was it. You knew you were part of something special. And even though we were fighting relegation to the old third division at the time, you just knew you had to be a part of that. And if you didn't want to be a part of that, you were taking a risk to not to go along with it, because we brought into Kevin Keegan his philosophy, his style, his ideas from day one. And as George said, it was just an absolute joy to be a part of it, to witness it. You know, Keegan did make some mistakes along the way, but, you know, when you look back overall, it was just utter joy, and a great time to be a teenager, still a teenager then. But as I say, that 2 year period, I can't dispute what George has said there. It was, you know, there was no expectation. And the fact that by the end of that 2 year period, we went from, you know, risk of bankruptcy and third division football to qualifying for Europe, and that was it. We did. He said we were going to take off, and we did.
Can we just set the scene then from the football team? What happened at the end of the previous season, just for our listeners who might not have been around then or new to the club?
So the back end of 1992, Keegan came in February, and he had 16 games to basically save us from, well, for me, it was disaster. Relegation, would have lost all the star players. He came up with a contingency plan of signing the likes of Peter Garland and Darren McDonough, pretty much just journeymen, really. As a contingency plan in case we had to sell the likes of Peacock, Kelly, Kevin Scott, who was still a major asset then. But somehow, you know, for two games to go, we managed to turn it around and we did it. And again, I've touched on game support Newcastle. The last two to three games, Derby away, Pompey at home and Leicester away, but just I was there 4-3. And if you could bottle them three games and just say to people, look, just experience that. That's what support Newcastle United is all about. And that was, you know, as I said before, coming of age and introduction to a bit of everything, you know, violence, the team and the supporters coming together, very much like what George said before, a bit like today. It seems to be happening again. But, you know, there was uncertainty about Keegan, whether he was going to stay, because his contract was up only for them 16 games.
He walked away twice.
He walked away
not long after getting the job, when because he'd been told there'd be £1 million to spend, and that didn't turn up. Or I think Sir John Hall had made promises on behalf of the directors that the other directors couldn't keep, so he walked away and was persuaded back. And then it was, he took over on a consultancy basis. I think that was the sort of title. And he didn't sign the new contract, because this was very much the old board, but he was basically told he did have to sell his top players. And at one point, he'd asked Sir John, what happens if Newcastle go down? And Sir John had said, we go out of business. Now, whether that would have been the case or not, it certainly felt like it. Again, there were similarities. There was to now, in the sense that there was that existential stuff going on, except it was worse, because earlier in that season, Newcastle had a crowd of 13,000 for one of the matches. The season before, it had gone down to 10,000 for one of the matches. And it wasn't a fun thing to do. And there'd been year upon year of kind of boardroom strife. And it wasn't really until the summer that got sorted out. And Keegan agreed to stay. So staying up, he came in, the first thing he did, fumigate the training ground, he'd set a tone. They'd had a brilliant start, and then results tailed off. And as you say, it wasn't until the sort of real drama at the end of the season before that they stayed up. And then you thought, right, now we've got a chance. And it just clicked.
Can you set the scene then, George? It is August 1992. What is a young George Culkin doing with his life?
So I'll have to kind of peer back through the fuzz of beer and terrible memory. So I'd been away at university in Hull, which was certainly the shittest 3 years of my life. I don't mind saying that. And I came back home, no idea what to do. I'm from Durham. I'm a Durham lad. So I'd always lived around Durham. My kind of family had moved away. My mum had moved away. So I was kind of on my own. And I moved to Newcastle for the first time with my girlfriend at the time. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. There were writers in my family, but I didn't know that was what I, you know, was what I was going to do. And I was unemployed. I was unemployed for that year. So the first thing I wanted to do was get back to watching Newcastle. And I ended up watching, I didn't have a lot of money, but I ended up watching every home game that season, including in the Anglo-Italian Cup, I think it was. And it was just an astonishing, it was just astonishing from the start. And professionally, it had a profound impact on me, because I think halfway through it was like I was bursting with stuff that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to write, and I've kind of brought along some of, well, it was the stuff I was first published in, which was a fanzine. It was the Mag. And, you know, this is why I will always do and always be grateful and very happy to do stuff with True Faith, because I'm a fanzine writer. That's what I am. I mean, that's my background. I'm from the fanzine generation. And it was, you know, it was actually going down to Maiden Castle to watch the team train that made me first want to write something. And yeah, that was it. That was it for me. It was just, but being part of the city in that year in particular was, it's very difficult to describe, but everything led up to the weekend. It was that old cliche. I was desperate. You were desperate to have that first drink at the weekend. There was also fear, not fear about what might happen on the Saturday, but the fear of not getting in. And so certainly for the early games, I was getting outside the ground with my mate 90 minutes before kickoff to queue up. Very different stadium back then. In my own head, it was started off at the Gallagate doing that and then going around to the paddocks. But from what I've written, looking back at what I've written, it looked like it was the other way around. But I can't admit that it looked like I ended up in the Gallagate. But by the end, I had to get a part season ticket just to be sure, to see the matches. You were petrified about not getting in. Grimsby, I think it was the 12th game that season, which they actually lost. They won 11 in a row, incredible. There were thousands of people locked outside. And it was, you know, it was astonishing. And I only got in because I was there early.
Mark, you've talked before on podcasts about 92, 93 perhaps being the last season when anyone in the city could go, both for accessibility in terms of not having to have a ticket, but also the price. Is that the case? Am I remembering correctly?
No, you're right, Alex. You know, you've got to hope, without flipping it too much into the current status, but you want to hope that we don't repeat what happened back then. John Hall did say there was going to be a price for every fan. No one was going to be locked out, and unfortunately, that didn't happen. You know, a lot of genuine supporters who had, you know, watched the shade for years, the relegations, you know, losing Waddle, Biazzi, Gascoigne, they were locked out. They couldn't afford it. And as George mentioned before, you had to buy a season ticket or a part season ticket to guarantee you would get in. Similar story to me. I was a Gallagher lad, Gallagher Corner, and we got up there a little bit too late. The gates were locked. It's something like 1:30 against, oh, against, I think it was Tranmere Rovers first. And that was a sign. Well, hang on, we're hitting capacity most games. But to be locked out, the turnstiles are shut. What do we do? Paddocks. We don't want to go in the paddocks. At that time, you thought people who go in the paddocks were old. That was the mentality you had. Let's go in the Leasers next to the away fans. We just managed to get in. But as George said, you were in the ground an hour and a half before kickoff, packed in like sardines, waiting for the game. And that was the buzz. And then
By the time the game started, your legs would be knackered just from standing still, either outside, yeah, or inside, and by full time you could barely walk because you'd been still. You couldn't move inside the actual ground.
And your voice was gone as well, because the pre-match build-up wasn't just turning up 10, 15 minutes as it is now for the flags. You know, God forbid, don't go back to the days when you're crawling at 5 past because you don't want to go in. But back then, they were singing every player's name when they were coming out to warm up.
Yep.
And, you know, there was a little bit banter between the Gallagher end and the corner and the scoreboard. But yeah, going back to your point, you did see a change there. Without fast-forwarding too much, I always remember when we got to the Premier League and Keegan was interviewed on Football Focus, first game of the season, Tottenham at home, and it was a big, what's the right word? It was just a lot of, you know, noise about Newcastle being in the top flight again, where we deserve to be. You know, the season ticket, the ground was full of season ticket holders, and Keegan was interviewed pitch side before the game. Never forget it. And they were talking about the lockout, season ticket holders only, and Keegan went, well, John Hall would sell my seat in the dugout if he could. And he was true, because years later we had the unfortunate incident with the bond scheme and the Save Our Seats, the Platinum Club and things like that, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. But you're certainly right, Alex, and that for me was a change in probably the personnel who was going. It wasn't just you walk in, you know, leaving the pub at 5 to 3 from the Strawberry and popping in. You had to get there early, or you had to go and get a ticket, and ultimately that's what the likes of me and George had to do. You know, I was fortunate that a friend of mine's mother paid for mine, and my mother paid for my brother's, because she couldn't afford them both. It was a big outlay. But yeah, it definitely changed. But, you know, when you look back, it was a change for a positive reason, for a change.
Take us to that summer then, Mark. You know, these days the transfer market is all-consuming. What was it like back then? Was it the kind of summer that set fans pulses racing because of the type of signings, or was it the popular phrase used today in 2022, evolution, not revolution?
I tell you what, the biggest thing I remember is I was going on a school holiday to France, and I remember coming up with my mother to get some holiday clothes, as you do, new shorts, tops, etc. And where the gate is now, there used to be a sports shop, but the name fails me. Next to the there was a Mayfair bar club where they used to put bands on, and then there was a couple of sports shops. And I remember going in there, and how you heard the news was the Pink or the Chronicle headline when you walk through Newcastle. And I walked out, and someone was selling the Pink, and I picked up a copy, and it had venison signs. Now, for me, that was a huge statement, because Barry Venison was, you know, a successful player in a brilliant Liverpool side in the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, rumour has it, just by educating and swatting up on Venison, I found out that he turned down a new contract and a guaranteed testimonial to come and play for Kevin Keegan. Now, obviously, as a 14, 15-year-old at the time, you didn't know that. You just knew that we had signed a top-quality, top-flight player. But the big one for me was Bracewell. Paul Bracewell, Sunderland's captain. You know, he was an England player. Apart from injuries, he could have been top class. You know, he could have been an England regular for years. And ironically, it was Billy Whitehurst who did him up at St. James's Park in a game between Newcastle and Everton. But that was a huge statement, a little bit of a piss take out of the Magnums. We've took your best player. You know, and it took a while for Bracewell to really get going at Newcastle, apart from his debut, of
scored
course.
In his first goal. Yeah.
But what a player he turned out to be. And then when you look at John Beresford as well, you know, the feel a medical at Liverpool, and Keegan apparently phoned him up and says, don't worry, you'll not feel the medical here. Which says something good about Keegan, but also something bad about Newcastle's, you know, medical. But you took it in your stride. You didn't know what was coming. I mean, God forbid now, I try and switch off from Twitter, because you... there's that many rumours. You just want hard facts, don't you? You want to wake up and go, we've signed Trippier, we've signed Byrne. You just want that. But Christ, you couldn't help but be excited by it, because every single player we were buying, similar to January, was an improvement on what we had. So even though they didn't set the world alight, you knew that there were better players, and it was a statement of intent, as a cliche goes.
And I remember being chuffed to bits that Kevin Scott stayed. I remember the Chronicle that day, you know, and certainly not kind of comparing him to sort of past brilliant players that have been at Newcastle and been sold on, but that felt important to me that he was staying. And of course they'd had the moment earlier when Keegan had, you know, had said he was leaving, because the threat was that players like Peacock or Kelly would be sold. And you know, with the new players coming in, there was definitely something to sort of build on there. I was going to say about Kevin Scott, the joke I always used to tell was that I thought that his name was Scottyman to start with, because people shouted Scottyman, because he did have a mistake in him. But I, you know, it was that felt like a really important moment. And so Newcastle had been a selling club, and now they were buying. Yeah. You know, the first time in a long time they were buying.
Kevin Keegan's the manager, and we've talked about what he did at the end of the previous season. George, a couple of questions for you. First of all, had you seen Keegan as a player? Was that a little bit before your time? Or
no,
you?
I'd seen him as a player, yeah. Seen as a player.
And so you were kind of fully aware, as Mark, you said you were 14, 15, you were both fully aware of his role in football in England, in Europe, and just how big a name he was at Newcastle. Did you both feel that?
100%, yeah, no, astonishing. And I was away when he came back to be manager. I was at college, but even that kind of one step removed, you just felt the impact. And there was just, you know, there was just that sort of almost telepathy there between him and the city and the club and the fans, and just on the wavelength, knew exactly what the team was about, knew exactly what the club should stand for and could stand for, and saw it. And, you know, that sort of, you know, that there is that sort of imagery of him being a kind of Pied Piper leading the club, but he would have done anything for Keegan. And he, you know, we've talked a lot about hope in the past few years at Newcastle, or the lack of hope until the takeover. He gave Newcastle hope, and, you know, he presented the best vision of Newcastle. And I think that was the kind of really exciting thing. You know, obviously his background as a player was astonishing. The stuff he did coming to Newcastle as a player the first time you know, was you'll never get a bigger shock than that. But it always had a special place in his own kind of heart and head, and he just always felt, he always had that sense of what the club could be, and it became that club. And I remember one of his, I don't know if it was his first set of programme notes that season, but it was certainly one of them, and he said, our aim has to be promotion to the Premier League. And it's like, what? But, I mean, within a game, two games, three games, we were believing it because the team was winning. And, I don't, you know, there's never been someone more in tune with the club than he was. And, you know, again, this takes us beyond this season, but, you know, the way he did it was just astonishing, to play the style of football that they did.
Yeah, Mark, 11 wins from the first 11 games. Do you want to just talk the listeners through a little bit what was that was like to experience?
Phenomenal. I mean, as you know, we did the podcast with David Kelly the other week, and what a joy to hear his own memories. And you know, you've got these sort of thoughts in your head about how you expect the players to be, and everything he said was exactly how you want them to be. They were in touch with the supporters. They were in touch with the city. Those were the days where you could just go to them in the car park at the old Millburn reception and ask them for tickets. And if it get you a ticket, so we'll get you a ticket. It was as simple as that. And but the first 11 games, you know, obviously Paul Bracewell screaming the opening minutes against Southend, and we're absolutely battered on that day, but we only won 3-2, which was probably a sign of Keegan's philosophy, you know, starting from the front, you know, from attack and defend from attack, really. But the biggest one for me, we had some cracking wins. I mean, we battered Bristol City. I remember that one 5-0 in the pissing down rain. You had we took around about 10,000 to Peterborough for an away game. Wow. What holds 15,000?
Is that the famous clip on Twitter?
It is.
That game, is it? Wow. I thought, like, looking at the footage, I thought that was from like the early 80s, but
yeah, it's a clip I got a hold of, which I was late to get, and you've got to put it up. It was just, that was an experience. Because obviously, bear in mind as well, drifting a little bit here, but Gallagher and Leeds has had no roofs, but that was the singing sections. But by the end of this, well, by the time the season developed, the whole ground was singing. So you had noise, proper noise, for my experience, for the first time. But yeah, the 11 wins, we went to Derby, second game of the season. They had spent hugely on the likes of Paul Kitson, Gabby Deeney, Mark Pembridge, top quality players. They were going for a promotion under Arthur Cox, and we went down there and beat them 2-1. A couple of games earlier in the previous season, we got battered 4-1 with 3 sent off. So it was like, okay, we're going to go somewhere here. Yeah, but just going back to David Kelly, obviously he had a horror time at West Ham. And I asked him the question, you know, there was a big article in the local press, I think it was the Chronicle, how Kelly was desperate to score against West Ham, his former team. And he did. And the celebration, if you look back at the footage, the Gallagher end, it's, you're packed in like sardines, but everyone just jumps, a little bit like Keegan's debut. You can't move, but the celebration's just glorious. And one of my memories is we were in the Gallagher corner, and we jumped over the wall, sort of a little wall to keep you off the pitch, really. But we jumped on and jumped on the pitch. You could do that then. You could celebrate with the players. And I reminded David of that off air, and he was like, yeah, I remember that. He said, I had to push us back in before he's got nicked. It's sort of, you know what I mean?
On the Gallagher there, I mean, it wasn't like the, you know, safe standing we have now. There was nothing to stop you being pushed down. Yeah. I mean, there were barriers every now and again, but there was nothing to stop you being, it was like a swell, it was like a tide. Yeah. So if anything ever happened, there was this move forward and then this move back and this gradual move back. And I remember, I'm sure it was that season, you know, there are, you say, all crammed together, but you crammed together for 90 minutes before kickoff. There was me and my mate, someone threw up on the back of our trousers, turning around, seeing this trickle between your feet and looking back, and there was this old fella and he was pissing into one of those little Max Pax coffee cups. And it's like, what the fuck are you pissing into that for? You may as well just piss on the ground. Yeah. The coffee cup is serving no purpose there. And, you know, and people so pissed, but they're being kept on their feet because you're all squashed together like that.
You're held up.
But you're also all in it together, and what you were seeing on the pitch was so incredible that you would put up with all that stuff. And it wasn't, I don't know, I mean, my memory of it, the way I feel about it now, I think that one of the reasons, the shape of the team changed when Ferdinand arrived, and Ferdinand was incredible. I loved watching him, but I think, to use Keegan's phrase, they had to feed the beast or whatever like that, because he was so dominant aerially and stuff like that. 92, 93, it was all about these little triangles It was about these little passing triangles, and they passed the ball so quickly. Everybody was good in possession. And I suppose if I think back to the sort of championship, most recent championship seasons for Newcastle, it was all about, a lot of it was about overwhelming teams. But it was about the sort of the, I mean, overwhelming them with power, I suppose is what I mean. But it was a grind. This wasn't a grind. It was the opposite of a grind. It was adventure. It was adventure all the way through. And it was trickery. It was little passing moves. And again, it's not that Newcastle had been terrible before then, because under Ardiles, there was a commitment to play. You know, there was the young kids who came through, people like Watson and Clark and Howie and all the rest of it. They were good footballers. But this was something else. This was playing football from the gods, but winning at the same time. And I think that's the thing that I always remember. And then, of course, when Cole comes in later on in the season, you've then got, that other outlet and a goal-scoring machine. I loved Peacock and I loved Kelly. I loved the way they played. But, you know, then Cole takes it forward another step.
I think the highlights for me as well, I mean, I mentioned a couple there, but the victories at Middlesbrough, the Coca-Cola Cup, then we're a Premier League side, far better than us. We had an awful record against Middlesbrough at the time, but we went there in the second leg after a 0-0 draw, I think, and again, we took about 8,000 down, and we absolutely destroyed them 3-1. That was a huge statement. And then I think it was a week, might have been 10 days later, we went to Roker Park and beat Sunderland on their patch, first time since 56, something like that. Oh. And it wasn't just a case of we're beating the likes of Peterborough and Tranmere, etc. We were going to beat our local rivals as well. So that just took it to a totally, totally different level. And obviously, you mentioned the 11 wins out of 11. You know, the Sunderland game was the one where, you know, the they were adamant, oh, we're going to destroy your record, all the Sunderland supporters were telling me. We was being brought up in Jarrow and Hebbin and South Shields. We're going to beat you. They got beat 6-0 off West Ham on the telly the week before. They were never going to beat us. But they nearly stopped the winning. But Liam O'Brien's goal, I mean, that's another podcast in its
own. Yeah, away games, George. Were you any away games across the season, or were you just at home?
No, I couldn't afford it. But I was glued to the radio, and that was the other thing. You know, Saturdays were still revolved around the match, and it was listening to it, because I think it was so compelling that you had to still be part of it. But no, away games weren't. Sadly, weren't sort of on my agenda that season.
They were for you, Mark, I imagine.
I was hooked by then. As I said before, you know, I ended up getting I did a milk round for a while, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and probably about £8 a week or something. It was ridiculous. Then it was like, all right, I can't get out of bed that early anymore. I'm falling asleep at school. Let's get a paper round. Let's be normal. Get a paper round. Probably about £10 a week. That paid for me away games. Used to go with the old Haymarket branch, Armstrong Galley. Never forget the name of the coaches. It's not there anymore. It's interesting because we're reminiscing, but a lot of things have gone now, you know. But the Haymarket supporters branch, we used to leave from there. I went to Derby. That was fantastic. But I was absolutely hooked. And again, I touched on before about a bandwagon. You know, we bought into what Kevin Keegan was talking about, and you knew that every away game you had to come up to the ground and basically wag school in the morning to come and get a ticket. There's none of this online business. You had to come up. Not get a ticket off at 9 o'clock. Get a ticket, queue up, get a ticket, and hopefully you join the queue at the right time to get one.
But the stadium here was different as well. You know, the actual makeup of the Gallagher end, you had the turnstiles and you had that like scrubland, didn't you? Yeah. Leading up there. I can't even sort of describe that. I find it difficult to picture that in my head, but it was like this, that you walked upstairs, but you had scrubland.
Yeah.
Around you, because it was just a big mound of concrete, wasn't it?
It was a mound of concrete with trees, bushes, and all sorts. And a rumour has it that some people who were homeless used to get into the game and then hide in the bushes because they had nowhere to go. There is stories doing the rounds about that.
But it didn't necessarily always. It wasn't always a positive. But the directors post takeover back then did understand what they had going for them, because the ground was sold out every week.
Yeah.
And so they very quickly started moving to redevelop. But no, physically, the whole place was... I mean, I've got little things that stick in my head. I can't remember which game it was, but it was second half of the season. Going to the pub, I went to the fourth hotel, post-match usually with my mate, and I just remember being there chattering away about the game, slamming my pint down on one of those old cast iron radiators at the exact minute that my mate was leaning forward, and he just stopped, and because my pint glass shattered into a million pieces, and he just stopped and he said, "Phone an ambulance." It was like, "What? No, phone an ambulance. What do you mean? I've swallowed glass." And I started laughing. It's like, I'm not gonna phone an ambulance. You're perfectly fine. So no, I've swallowed a bit of glass there, and that's going to tear my esophagus. It's not funny. It is funny. Anyway, so I completely refused to phone him an ambulance. But anyway, he was serious, and we stayed there. So we were like locked in this. We were locked in this sort of argument, and so he agreed to very gingerly move from the pub, and there was an ambulance by the central station, so we got in this ambulance, and then I sat with him for 2 hours. He refused to move. He just wouldn't move because he was certain that if he moved, his insides were going to get torn apart. Anyway, Saturday night, poor fucking doctors, they finally look at him and said, "Well, we don't know if you swallowed a bit of glass or not, but just eat loads of mashed potatoes and expect a gritty stool in a couple of weeks." And it was like, and it's like things like this sick in my head. Yeah. But I mean, the other side of the football club was that the training ground was open, and so I was doing that as well. So I didn't go to away games, but I did go to the training ground, and because that was like getting your football fix during those off weeks, and you could just go down, and there was that, you know. So you go down to start with, there would be a couple of hundred people there. Maybe, but you're by the pitch. Keegan opened the whole club out, and there they were, just playing football, occasionally punching each other. I remember Clarkey. There was a bad tackle. Clarkey turned around, whipped around, punched Benny Christensen in the face, and wasn't all over the papers. But you were right close, and then the longer that went on, the bigger the crowds got, to the point that there were burger vans and ice cream vans coming down there, and it would take the players, if they braved the crowds after a training session, it would take them ages and ages to get through them. There's so many people there, so you had this whole, you know, the match day feeling was actually there, not just at the weekend, it was there during the week as well, because you could just go and watch them train.
Yeah, I have to remind listeners at the minute, the stuff we're talking about, it is the first division, the championship. This isn't, you know, top of the Premier League or anything like that. I mean, it's when people talk about passion for football in the Northeast and Newcastle in particular, I think this stuff that you guys are describing is an excellent example of that, because this is, you know, there's some very good footballers here. I'm going to talk about some more very good footballers in the second who played this season. But George, you were going down, I imagine, on a Tuesday morning or a Wednesday afternoon to go and watch lads train. And that might sound great to people at the minute, but I personally couldn't, you know. It just seems like a ridiculous concept that a football team would let the public watch them train for the week up ahead. Marcelo Bielsa's had to send loads of spies to Derby County. He went to do the same. But it just sounded incredible. Mark, I have to ask you before we move on, did you hospitalise anyone that season?
No. I'm probably should have hospitalised myself, the amount of alcohol I drank. But no, I'm pleased to say no.
Nice one. Well, Mark, tell us, let's move on then. Let's move into the crux of the season. There's some key, you know, I'll tell you what was your favourite game of that season?
Oh, favourite.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
It would probably have to be... Middlesbrough was a huge, huge statement and would had no joy against Middlesbrough over that period. But if I had to pick one, if I had to take one to the grave with us, it would probably be the Leicester. The last game. I think, you know, I know we're getting ahead of the season. I'm not going into it too much, but that just, everything that was supposed to go right went right that day. And plus I turned, I would have been 15 the next day. And again, I wagged school to go to the victory parade up at, Haymarket, where they finished. It would be Leicester, the 7-1 final game of the season.
George, same question, right?
Yeah, probably be that game. I mean, I've just written, I was telling you, Alex, on the way in tonight, that I've just written a whole article about a game, it turns out, that I was at and had no memory of it as I was actually writing it. And that is a problem. But I do remember that. I do remember those scenes right at the end. In my mind, they're kind of blurred into the moment when there's the open-top bus and the players at the Civic Centre and Keegan saying, you know, I was there then. Keegan saying, tell Alex Ferguson we're coming after you. You know, that sense. And that was just that. Just that sort of jubilation, but I suppose that was the icing on top of the cake. Whereas I think the games right at the start of the season, although I can't really differentiate them in my own head, would probably be my favourite because it was that sense of having to get there that early and that sort of anticipation and just being astonished by what was happening in front of you. They were winning again, and everybody just wanted to be part of it and to celebrate it. And you know, if you bring that back to now, the lovely thing is that it's not just old twats like me having to talk about those feelings, because those feelings are back again. People wanting to be at that, you know, just desperate to be there, to witness it, to be part of it somehow. You know, that was the overwhelming feeling back then. Leicester was very, very special, but you know, because you knew that was waving goodbye to that division and then starting off on the next bit.
If I can just add to that, personal memories is obviously getting up there early because it was a huge celebration. Apparently Keegan walked out at halftime against Oxford midweek because we got promoted at Grimsby. We played on the Tuesday. We played Oxford on the Thursday at home. And apparently because I'd been on the drink all week, the players didn't perform and apparently Keegan walked out. And Terry Mack says, he's gone. He's been shite. But I put your ideas up. Went up winning 2-1. So by the Sunday, we still had been on the drink all week. But, you know, we had the new ASIC strip, bold black and white stripes. We had the Leasers end coming up in the background. Lindisfarne played a set on the Leasers. But for us being kids, it was great because you took that risk that of invading the pitch before the game. You ran up with the players. I remember shaking Steve Howie and Kevin Scott's hands. Congratulations, Steve. I went, what the fuck are you doing on here? I said, oh, we're just jumping on. You know, there was, you know, people just taking turns around the pitch. But the our nostalgia person in me, I think the good thing about that is when I went home and watched, because it was live on ITV, when I watched it back, you had Chris Waddle was doing the co-commentary with Roger Timms, and you had Peter Beardsley in the studio. So a touch back to the days where we were hanging our hats on individual players at this point, then we're probably watching with probably a little bit envy. We're not a part of this, and you could sense with Kevin Keegan in charge and Terry Mack being assistant, they were probably looking at it and going, wow, they really are going places now, and they weren't a part of it.
Beardsley would be about to be again.
So Newcastle win 11 in a row, Mark. Was promotion done at this point, looking back? No,
Even at that tender age, you just knew you couldn't take it for granted. You know, we had some slips on the way. I remember, again, wagging school to get a ticket for Barnsley away. And George is, you know, reminiscing there about a story in the pub. I was still too young to go into the pubs, but we'd still have a couple of cheeky cans on the coaches. But Barnsley, we'll never forget that because the night before went to a house party. And I mean, the lads who I still go to the games with now, we got drunk and we had a hangover. But we were going to Barnsley the next day. And for the first time, I was thinking, I've got a hangover. This is a hangover. I can't go to Barnsley. I need to just lie in bed all day. But we went and we got beat 1-0. Barnsley were near the bottom of the league. And we were beating everyone inside. But it was interesting, George was saying before, about how it was such a joy to watch the little pockets and the diamonds and all that. But we didn't do it live on TV. We had a horrible record when the ITV picked us on the Sunday. We just couldn't win a game. But yeah, I mean, going into Christmas, we were miles clear, possibly 10, 11, 12 points. And then we had that blip, didn't we, George, in January, where we just couldn't seem to win a game. But it didn't seem to bother the supporters because FA Cup was still hugely important then. And we went on an FA Cup run. But no, I would be a liar if I said I was 100% confident. You knew, you had faith in Keegan, you had faith in the players, but you, being Newcastle fans, even then, you just couldn't take it for granted. Not until it was 100% done.
I've just picked out one of these old copies of the mag. Just to kind of make this point, it says a lot about me, I'm afraid. I mean, and I haven't changed in this sense, because at exactly that moment where there was a bit of a wobble, I was shitting myself because, you know, it would go wrong. And I mean, the other side of it was, even as things were good, I was shitting myself because I was already anticipating the moment when it stops being good. I looked to the future, not just with hope, but also with trepidation. Knowing only too well that the difference between good and bad luck can teeter on a knife edge. Would promotion only let us in for a season-long battle to maintain our hard-won status? Da, 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 da. And so I think all, you know, I think Newcastle's impoverishedness as a club, but also as a footballing entity, was so fresh then that you couldn't take any of it for granted. I think, you know, to make the comparison between then and now, suddenly, you know, Newcastle's takeover now is transformative because of the wealth of the ownership. I mean, that is fact. That wasn't fact back then. I mean, there was a very ambitious ownership, and they did have money, but it wasn't the same kind of, you know, it wasn't the same kind of thing at that point. They were, you know, they did go on to break transfer records as Newcastle grew, but there was nothing there. You know, you knew that the season before, the idea of going out of business was very, very real. And so I think, you know, for maybe that's where that came from for me. You know, that has always come from that. No, I'm anticipating the first defeat. So it wasn't this thing. I don't think at that point it did feel like a bandwagon. I think by the time 95, 96 comes along and Newcastle are up there, top of the table, I think everybody around the club at that point had that sense that, okay, we didn't do it this season. That was shit. That was really difficult, but we'll do it next season. Yeah. You know, and so that was a very different feeling. Whereas back then there was still that, no, this is gossamer thin this. We've got to enjoy it while we can. And the celebration, as Keegan sort of said in his book, you know, the celebratory fact was it was all new. So it hadn't happened before, this feeling. But we also knew how close we were to jeopardy.
Incredible. And Mark, there were several players you wanted to touch on this season. I mean, this is a season, again, what is now the Championship First Division, but this is a season of heroes. This is a season of absolute heroes. You did the David Kelly podcast, yeah, on True Faith, and the response was just, you know, 10,000 people listened to that podcast. Yeah. From amazing. A guy who played for Newcastle United, 20 years ago, is it 30 years ago in the first division?
Yeah.
That probably symbolised to me, who wasn't around for that as a supporter, just how important he still is. And, you know, there was the flag display, which, you know, you had a very big hand in, yeah, with war flags. You know, talk us through some of the players of that season and why they meant so much to fans.
Well, David Kelly admitted himself, didn't he, that, you know, everyone went up a different level when Keegan arrived. You made them feel special. Everyone's heard the stories, you know. You know, like what he said to Robert Lee, who I haven't even mentioned yet, who came in. He was a great signing, you know, and Keegan was good at that. He would always improve every single position. And, you know, Franz Carr did an okay job, but Robert Lee came in and took us to a different level. You know, and he was good at that around the whole pitch. Robert Lee was fantastic, head and shoulders, the best player that we had at the moment. But then you look at the likes of John Beresford. John Beresford ended up getting called up the England squad by the end of the season. Wow. You know, is a championship, first division, whatever you want to call it, player. Venison was top-notch. We had two good full-backs who could play football, tackle, but, you know, link up with the midfielders. You know, Liam O'Brien, again, like, he's probably forgotten about in some ways how important he was for stopping up and then going up. Probably because he got injured towards the end and Paul Bracewell came in. But again, Paul Bracewell, for me, was an upgrade on O'Brien because he was phenomenal and he played a huge part in the first season back in the top flight. But Lee Clark for me was just absolutely phenomenal. And if, bear in mind, he was still only 19, 20-ish. He was superb. He was our best player under Ozzy. I think George mentioned there the train around spats with Clarkie and Benny Christensen. If I remember rightly, he did a dodgy tackling one of Keegan's first train, so Keegan dropped him. He dropped him straight away. He says, you haven't got the mentality to play against Bristol City. And obviously, we battered Bristol City 3-0. Then we had liftoff, you know. And but he Keegan could also know who was chances. You know, we had Terry Wilson from Nottingham Forest on loan. He was a good player for a good Nottingham Forest side, but he couldn't get a game. So he came to Newcastle on loan. And, you know, he made it clear to Keegan, I'll play me four games, but I'll not be stopping. And Keegan went, right, see you later. Dropped him straight away. Brought in David Roach. You know, that's, in Keegan knew, if you don't want to play for Newcastle, that's it. There's no point. But after Lee Clark's, you know, dodgy start, shall we say, under Keegan's management, he was just superb. And people take the piss a little bit out of Clark. He's saying, you know, jigs, so he felt a piece in the box. But he had a lot more about his game than getting in the box and scoring goals. He was box-to-box. And George has mentioned again about the 95-96 season. He adapted to be a sort of a holding midfield player, but still bombing on. Back then, he was, you know, linking everything up. You know, you could go through the whole team, you know, even bringing in the likes of Mark Robinson, who was unfortunate at the end. He was a great prospect from Barnsley, good fullback. And then he had the idea for putting Venison as a centre-half, really. But it didn't work out with him. But Scott Sellers, you know, he was an upgrade on Kevin Sheedy, who had a fantastic career, but he was getting old. He had lost a yard of pace. Scott Sellers was still only 26, 27. Wasn't getting a game at Leeds, and he was brilliant.
And a proper footballer.
Yeah.
Sellers was a footballer. He really was. And you had Steve Howie at the back.
Yeah.
You know, and Keegan hadn't moved him from centre forward to centre back, but it was cemented under Keegan, and he was, you know, he was astonishingly good. And yeah, it was that combination of everything, the players that came in, lifted everybody, the players who were already there, you know, just rose to the challenge, a bit like what we've just seen. And Keegan was the sort of absolute pivotal figure in that, because as you said earlier, Beresford had a chance to move from Portsmouth to Liverpool. Rob Lee had the chance to go to Borough, who were in the Premier League. And, you know, there's the famous story about persuading him that Newcastle was closer to London than Middlesbrough, which I suppose he meant by train or whatever it was. But it was Keegan that really set that going. And then it was also the mood that he set sort of within the club, that the ambition was boundless, and you know, the message to the players wasn't tactical, it wasn't detailed in those terms. He had a way that he wanted to play, but he made everybody feel better about themselves and told them to go out and show it, and they did. And it's, you know, it sounds so easy when you put it like that, but putting all those things together at the same time, I mean, every one of those players was a hero. Everybody rose to the challenge. That was the thing.
You know what it is? Well, I haven't even mentioned Gavin Peacock as well.
No, Peacock.
What a great player Gavin Peacock was. He could play anywhere. But Keegan, again, just give him the freedom. You know, I think they're saying something like when he played for Liverpool, and Shankly says, just run around and drop these little bombs or grenades or something, make yourself known. And apparently Keegan said exactly the same to Gavin Peacock, and Peacock improved as a player. And the first half of that season, Peacock was probably our best player and our goal scorer. And again, unfortunately, injury changed his trajectory that season, but very important overall.
Brilliant. Andy Cole comes in. I don't know, again, this is why we're used to other the stars here. How exciting was that signing? Was it exciting? Was he a known player? Did you know what was to come, George, when Andy Cole signs for Newcastle?
Oh, God, that's... That's difficult. It's difficult to remember. No, I mean, I think had he played it against Newcastle earlier that season?
A couple of weeks earlier before he signed, we played Bristol City away.
Yeah.
And he tore Scott and Howie inside out. Keegan went.
That's right. And that was, again, pretty sort of typical of, you know, of Keegan as well. It's like, all right, I'll have a bit of that. And again, he just lifted everything. He just lifted everything again. Peacock wasn't a centre forward. He wasn't a number nine kind of character, but Cole was. He was, given the ball and he would, well, as the song went, gets the ball, scores a goal. He missed a lot, but he scored a lot. And at that vital moment, it just lifted standards again. And again, you know, I love that about the team. As I said before, my love for Les Ferdinand will always be there. But the way Newcastle played that season and the season after, it was about movement and it was about finding space and it was little passes. It wasn't about whipping in crosses that Ferdinand would get on the end of. It was much more, it felt much more subtle to me. But Cole was dynamite just in a different way.
I think I remember where I was. I was in a chemistry class at school and the teacher told us, Newcastle have signed Andy Cole for 1.75 million. Never forget it. And we were like, what? Newcastle don't spend 1.75 million. We're more than doubled our transfer record, which was 5 years previously. But yeah, a little bit like George, I knew of him. He had scored, around about 17, 18 goals for Bristol City that side, and a pretty poor Bristol City side. But I can't remember being totally excited about it, but wow, within a couple of weeks, you just knew straight away. And he was an instant fan favourite. And you, in a way, you felt a little bit sorry for the likes of Peacock and Kelly because all of a sudden, you had Andy Cole having that song sang about him. And the whole team was built around Andy Cole. But I think, did he end up getting something like 13-13, two hat-tricks in that championship season? He was sort of like the icing on the cake and... just phenomenal. And for me, along with Mr. Shearer, with nice poster on the wall there, along with Shearer, he makes my all-time 11, just ahead of Ferdinand, because, again, going back to that two-year period where Cole was at the club, it was just a simple joy to watch him play. But, yeah, and, you know, I think Andy Cole, despite him coming out late, I've spoken to him at Talkings and stuff, and, you know, I think he just couldn't get his head around the adulation, could he, George? You know, that the whole fact that he was living in a goldfish bowl, and he couldn't get it. He couldn't live with it.
Well, I think he was. I think there was. You know, the club had no infrastructure back then. Yeah. It was still growing, and I think he was sent out to. I can't remember which. It was a pit village in County Durham to live and all that kind of stuff. And there was no sort of, you know. I think he sort of found that sort of stuff quite difficult, as you would. But I was just thinking back there when you were talking about, you know, how did you feel when they signed Andy Cole? Of course, there was no. I mean, if you supported Newcastle, then you would read about. If you supported Newcastle in the Championship, you would read about them in the local papers. You wouldn't read about them anywhere else. I mean, very, very occasionally, you might get a report in one of the nationals, but rarely. And when the football stopped for the summer, so did reporting on football. And so you could go for weeks on end without seeing mention of your team in the paper, which is astonishing now when you think about it. And of course, there was no social media. There was no, you know, there was very little television coverage, and it certainly wasn't wall to wall like we've got now. So you only really saw the opposition players unless you were a total and utter nerd. And I don't know how you would kind of even manage to be that. Mm-hmm. You only saw those players either at the very rare occasion they'd be on telly or when your team played them. So it's not like you had this like vast database of knowledge like we see now when Newcastle are linked with a player, you'll immediately get those, oh, brilliant, you know, here's his highlights from Ligue 1 or whatever. It's like, that stuff just did not exist. So it was only players that you'd heard of, really, who might have played in the top division and were joining Newcastle, or you'd seen play, because there wasn't that other side of it. You didn't see other footballers.
So as we come to the end of this podcast, George, I'm interested, how big a role did this season play in your career? Did you start writing professionally about football at this time, or was that to come later?
So it was the season that I started writing about football, and it was the more that I did that, the more I wanted to do that. I found that I had to kind of, I mean, obviously you got your emotion out on a weekend, on a Saturday, but I wanted to express myself. And I think I've often talked about Gascoigne being the first player that did that for me, but just because what he did on the pitch was so extraordinary. that it was this like violent poetry, and I needed to kind of get some kind of poetry out as well. But it was this season, and being part of it and watching it every week and being pissed at the weekend and spending the whole time, you know, I was kind of rediscovering Newcastle, and I was living in Newcastle and this brilliant, vibrant city that was just aflame at the weekend. I had to get it out somehow, and writing for the mag was the way that I kind of did that. And so I suppose the more I did it, the more I thought, I wonder if there's something there. And yeah, a year or so later, I then did a journalism course at Darlington. And I then, at the end of that, I had usual lazy twat, I hadn't done anything about it. But there was a note on the wall to do work experience at the Sunday Sun. That's the local Sunday paper for those who don't live in the city. Not the tabloid, not the national tabloid. And I started doing work experience. Within a few months, that became a job. And within another few months, I was back at the training ground, still open to fans, interviewing the players that I'd been watching. Yeah, 95, 96. I mean, my first kind of full-time gig was actually covering Sunderland under Mick Buxton. So that was kind of quite, I mean, that was a very different vibe to what was happening at Newcastle. But during the week, I would be going to the training ground at Newcastle to do features and do interviews. And yeah, 95, 96, I was covering Newcastle in that season. And I've forgotten all of it. I wish I could like remember so to more of that. But when Saturday came along, I was shitting myself because I didn't know what I was doing professionally, and I had the deadlines to work to, and I was dictating copy over the phone because that's what we had to do back then. No laptops, you know, no internet, nothing like that. But yeah, it was very surreal to kind of go from those seasons to pretty soon afterwards being, you know, writing about it, and then because the training ground was open back then, I became friends with those footballers. I got to know those footballers. I got to know Lee Clark and Steve Watson. Steve Howie became the best man, you know, became my best man. I mean, I would go out drinking with him. And so it all started. I mean, it started earlier when I first went to watch Newcastle, I guess. And, you know, the same story as everybody else. When I was a kid, went with my stepdad, Gordon, who took me for the first time. And sort of stirred that. But it was this season that opened it all up for me. So I've got this season and Keegan to sort of thank for that. As a fan, I mean, I don't, you know, you don't want to be one of those people who say it was better in my day, because that's kind of unfair. But what I loved about now is that there is a replication of that feeling. What I would love is for the football to come close to it, you know, for it to be successful football, but just that headlong, we will beat you football. We will beat you by being better than you. And if we don't beat you by being better than you, then we'll probably lose. Yeah. But, you know, more often than not, they were better. And, you know, and again, it was pre-mobile phone. So at the same time as you had the team winning on the weekend, you would have the team celebrating in the city. And so there was no separation at the training ground. There was very little separation at the stadium, as you were saying, Mark. And then there was no separation after the match because everybody would be out. Everybody was out on the town. And, you know, as the team grew in the subsequent seasons, you would have that thing where you would get into a taxi, you would get on the bus. Everybody had a story about a Newcastle player who'd been out, seeing a Newcastle player, being part of it. And it was that level of intensity was ridiculous, but it was also very, very symptomatic of everybody being in it together. And, you know, Newcastle was growing as a city, was changing as a city, was becoming, you know, was becoming different. You know, the old industry was going and it was becoming something else. And football was at the forefront of that. You know, it was Newcastle became a party city, but Newcastle were a party team. I don't mean drinking. They played like a party. You wanted to be there and be part of it, and it was fucking fun. It was unbelievable. And it's, of course, it's the bedrock on which everything is based now. I mean, Amanda Staveley wouldn't have come to St James's Park and fallen in love with Newcastle, to use her words, if Keegan hadn't got Newcastle in the Premier League, because that's what it's all based on. This, it's all based on this version of the club. You know, he saw the potential, he felt it, and yeah, there's been some pretty shitty, horrible years in the intervening time, but that's what the modern version. This is what the modern version of Newcastle stands on.
Any closing comments, Mark?
No, I think what George said is absolutely perfect. And don't forget Keegan, when he was a player, when he left, when he retired, he had the vision then. He told the club, go and get, you know, spend money, go back, you know, not bankrupt, but get yourselves into debt. Go and buy players, go and progress. This side does not need to be relegated ever again, this football club. And then when he came back for Kenny Wharton's testimony in 1989, the club on the brink of relegation, he came back for Kenny Wharton's testimony, he had a few harsh words to say. He said then, lovely new stand, Millburn stand had just been built. Lovely new stand, but stands don't win you football games. It sticks with you. And then he come back in 92 and he still had that vision. He hadn't lost his love, he hadn't lost his passion. And Christ, you know, it was just a joy to go along with Kevin Keegan and that sort of, that 4, 5, 6 year period under his management. But as was said at the start of the show, you know, that I'm with George, 92, 94, them 2 years were just absolutely incredible.
Very sorry, we'll go on for it. I mean, I could do this forever, but to go back to that very start, the thing we didn't say, when he arrived at the club, when he came back as manager, he'd been out of football for eight years. He'd been living in Marbella playing golf. He'd come back to this country just before then and didn't know what to do. But he says himself, he wouldn't have gone to any other club to be manager. He said if Liverpool had asked him, where obviously he'd been phenomenal, he wouldn't have gone. It was only Newcastle he'd have done it for. And so that sense of new, it was all new to him. He didn't know the players in the Championship. And so when you look back on that achievement, to get from the very bottom of the division to the top in the space of one season, not knowing effectively, you know, the players, the teams, with a board that didn't really know what it was doing, that had come in. And I mean, so it was that sense of freshness was everywhere. There was like a naivety about us as a fan base, because it had been so bad for so long. It's like, oh my God, what is it? You know, it was that sort of feeling. What is it that we're witnessing? And Keegan personified that because he had it himself. It was fresh to him too. You know, he hadn't managed a single match in his life before coming to Newcastle. I mean, it was incredible. It's ridiculous, stupid, really. I don't know what the sort of obvious, I don't know if you can think of an example of something modern, but it was, I mean, it was nonsense to base it on Keegan, but it worked. It worked perfectly, and everything about it was fresh. Everything about it.
Brilliant. Well said. Well, thanks to Mark and George. What a lovely conversation to have sat here and witnessed. It was brilliant. I'm very envious that I wasn't around in 1992-93 for that fantastic season. Thanks to you both. We'll be back with another True Faith Free podcast this time next week. Bye bye.